Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2005. This session is Job, Standing in Dust and Ashes, presented by Michael Pellet in the Fireside Room, disc number POM-2005-06. Let's listen in.
And we shall begin. Welcome. My name is Michael Pellet, and I'm a pastor at a Lutheran church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and also teach philosophy and some religious studies in the College of St. Thomas More on the University of Saskatchewan campus in Saskatoon. And this week, what we'll be looking at are some of the passages in the book of Job. And I've chosen Job to fit in with the theme of take off your shoes, because Job is, if you will, a foil to Moses and the call of Moses and that standing on holy ground, that as we read both in the beginning and the end of the book of Job, Job ends up in dust and ashes, which usually we don't think of as holy ground. And so Job works as a foil, as I've said, to the way in which God and Moses are presented in Exodus. And so we'll be looking at the way in which God and our understanding of relationship with God, which is what Job embodies, are presented in this book. And as we'll see, it raises some very, very tough questions. And for that, I need to set some ground rules for our time together. And that is, I get to ask the tough questions. You don't, because I don't have the answers to the tough questions. So I ask tough questions. You provide answers to tough questions. Okay, that's how it works, all right? Just so we're all clear on that from the very beginning. Today, we'll look at the introduction, if you will, to the book of Job. That's Job chapters 1 and 2. Most of Job is written in poetry. So if you like poetry, you should like Job. What is not in poetry are the first two chapters. They're more the kind of declarative narrative, if you will, and the very end, the last half of the last chapter of the book of Job is also narrative rather than poetry. Everything else is poetry. Today we'll look at that opening narrative section, chapters 1 and 2, because it sets the question, that tough question that we're going to try to look at and investigate. And so what I have here on the board is simply a little outline and diagram to help us see the way in which those first two chapters are organized. Starts with an introduction. And then we have, if you will, two shifting scenes. And so after the introduction, we go up to heaven and listen in on a dialogue between God and, of all beings, Satan. So one of the things we'll already have to ask ourselves, too, is what is Satan doing in heaven? And at least according to Job, quite frankly, that's where Satan belongs. So that'll shake our thinking a little bit to say Satan belongs in heaven. All right. But we'll just move on. Then after that, we shift right down to earth and the dialogue between Job and the messengers that bring Job bad news. Then we go to chapter 2, where we have again two more scenes in heaven and earth. Back up to heaven. And God and Satan have another dialogue back down to earth, a dialogue between Job and his wife, and then an ending conclusion. And so We're simply going to try to work our way through these introduction and the scenes that happen in heaven and on earth, and find out what's going on. So first of all, if someone would read, please, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5.
In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom.
All right. What do you think about Job from those first 5 verses?
Pretty wealthy man.
Pretty wealthy man, to be sure. What else?
Concerned about his family.
Concerned about his family. So he's a good family man.
Blameless, upright, feared God, turned away from evil.
All right. Blameless and upright.
I also see him as trying to hedge his bet, talking about perhaps my children have sinned. You know, let's just hedge our bet here a little bit.
Very interesting that you use the word hedge. Don't forget that word, because it'll come up in just a little bit. What else do you think about Job?
He believes in a cause and effect relationship in the universe. If I do, then this will happen.
Seems to have some kind of cause and effect relationship. Anything else?
Pretty consistent that this is what Job always did.
My Bible calls him the most influential man in all the East.
Yeah, I mean, there are, again, background. Job is mentioned one other time in the Hebrew scriptures, and that's in Ezekiel chapter 14. And in Ezekiel chapter 14, as God is speaking, God notes kind of who are the 3 most righteous people that have ever lived in all the world. And they are, in this chapter, Noah, Daniel, and Job. So in that sense, Job is in the big 3 of the most righteous who have ever lived. And obviously, this introduction wants to say that as well.
You know, so I want to say in Fiddle on Roof, if I were a rich man, this is who he was thinking about.
Yes, for sure. Right. And so in other words, we all want to be like Job when we grow up, right?
Job may also think part of some reason for his success is his righteousness.
Ooh, that goes back to that cause and effect thing again, huh? Yeah. Few other things in here that, again, kind of the colorful language and symbolism. How many sons does Job have?
7.
Isn't that nice? How many daughters?
3.
3, right? 7, 3. Perfect. 7, the number of wholeness, completeness. 3, the number of stability. And who wouldn't want daughters who are stable?
Huh? Right.
You know, all that great. And of course, seven sons, three daughters gives you
ten
children, right? All right, 7, 3, 10, perfect numbers. Or think about that in terms of the his other animals and possessions. What are the numbers attached there?
5,000, 7,000
what?
Sheep.
And what else?
3,000
camels. So he's got sheep, so he's rancher, he's big into agriculture, but if he has camels, what do you use camels for?
Trade.
So he's both. Right? There's no middle person for this guy. He raises, he sells them. He's the merchant and the farmer, the total deal. And of course, 7,000 and 3,000, 10,000. Kind of like billions in our understanding of things. And again, donkeys and oxen, 500 each. So it all adds up. And part of that, again, is all of that symbolism, isn't it? To live your life where everything adds up. Wouldn't that be great? Wholeness, completeness, stability, it's all together, right? It is just wonderful. It couldn't be any better than that. Some other thing. In verse 4, it says here, this is my reading from the New Revised Standard Version. His sons used to go and hold feasts in one another's houses in turn. And what's translated there, in turn, literally, if from the Hebrew, would be translated each on his day, which is a phrase that basically talks about birthday parties. So Job's sons would have these tremendous birthday parties, times of celebration. And again, a birthday feast is a time of great importance because on your birthday, of course, you celebrate life, but you also celebrate the generosity, the abundance, the goodness which God has bestowed upon you, and, of course, pray and ask for another year of God's goodness and abundance and generosity. And so all of Job's, they just keep making the rounds, having these great birthday parties, celebrating their birthdays and all that's there. And it's within that context, of course, that Job makes these sacrifices for his children just in case what?
They sinned.
But not even openly and overtly, but where?
In their hearts.
So you see how cautious he is there, just in case maybe they weren't thankful enough for what God did. Job will do the sacrifices to make sure everything is okay, right? He's that scrupulous. He's that cautious. One could say he is that intent on his piety. And so we have this wonderful person who is called Job, who everyone wants to be like.
It doesn't say that Job was at the party.
No. And we'll see a little later, obviously, that he wasn't, right? When his children are killed. No, he's not always at the parties.
Sooner or later, you got to turn your kids loose.
I also notice here something, and they talk about that his sons had these parties, and they actually invited their sisters to eat and drink with them.
I know.
And that's significant, I think, for those days.
Again, a way of embodying this whole wholeness and togetherness, and you know, sisters are thought of so well that they actually come into the party. They're not second class people in any respect, right?
Well, they don't get to celebrate their birthdays.
I'm sorry, what?
They don't get to celebrate their birthdays.
Well, if we don't know about that, but again, it's a notion here again of a very holistic, healthy family, right? No dysfunctional codependency here, right? This is the perfect family. All right, now that we've got that idyllic, perfect picture, let's find out what's going on up in heaven. And so if someone, please, would read the first scene there, verses 6 through 12.
One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, all that he has is in your power, only do not stretch out your hand against him." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord.
All right, thank you. So here we are, up in heaven, and all the heavenly beings come together. Again, within the kind of mythology of the time, this would also signify a birthday party. This would happen, if you will, at the time when one celebrates the creation. So this would be like New Year's Day. On New Year's Day, as God creates, God gathers all the other heavenly beings together, and they all kind of sing, if you will, "Happy Birthday to Creation." And what a wonderful job God has done in creating. And of course, Satan, or HaShatan in Hebrew, is up there as well. Because, as we can see from this, Satan is not kind of the devil or evil incarnate, or however you may want to characterize that, that we see in places in the New Testament or elsewhere in the scriptures. But Satan here plays a very specific role in God's understanding of things. In verse 7, God asks Satan, "Where have you come from?" Which is an idiom that basically means, "Have you been doing your job?" And Satan, of course, answers, "Yes, I have." Now, what is the job of Satan? Anyone want to venture a guess there? What is the job which God has assigned to Satan?
To watch the humans.
To watch the humans.
To challenge us.
How does Satan watch and challenge? What is Satan supposed to do?
Well, he's an observer.
Yeah.
First.
Yeah.
He walks around and
And what's Satan supposed to observe?
Weaknesses.
Who is righteous or not righteous.
So in other words, Satan's task is to make sure that everyone is doing what they're supposed to be doing within the whole creation. Satan is the head of the CIA and the FBI and Homeland Security, all wrapped up in one. Right? That's Satan's job. And along with that, if you're not behaving, then Satan becomes the accuser. If you will, the prosecuting attorney, who would say, we'll pick up, look at Roy, look at what he's doing. He's out of line. Get him, God. So that's the understanding within this book of Satan's role. Or, I can't help but put this in, Satan is like Santa Claus. You know, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. Hashatan. Right? The accuser, the spy, the one who's checking up on you. And if you're not faithful, loyal, following God, Satan's going to make sure God knows, and Satan is going to throw the book at you. So that's why Satan belongs in heaven. Satan is part of God's way, if you will, of making sure that the whole cosmos, and particularly human beings within that cosmos, live according to God's ways. That's how Satan is understood here. And so Satan has certainly been doing his job. That's what verse 7 tells us. And then in verse 8, God focuses attention on Job. And in verse 8 again, God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? In other words, have you been checking up on Job? Have you, taken a look at that guy? And then God says, there's no one like him on earth. And it repeats again what we know from verse 1. Blameless, upright, fears God, turns away from evil. Now, why does God ask this question, do you think? Of all the people on earth, why is God singling out Job?
Because Job is so righteous.
Because Job is so righteous.
His best pupil.
So is God bragging?
Yes.
God's bragging. Hmm?
The CIA attorney, Satan, says, he's observing God.
We'll see about
he
that.
Says, God's prideful here. I'm going to bring him down.
Yeah.
Yeah,
as we work our way into verse 9 and the question that Satan asks, does Job fear God for nothing? Is that really an accusatory question addressed to God concerning Job? Or is that addressed to God concerning God? Who is Satan, if you will, challenging here?
God.
Ooh, that ups the stakes, doesn't it? That Satan would challenge God. And what's the challenge?
Make life a little rougher.
Let's see how good Job really is.
And why does Satan propose that test? What's that question trying to get at? Does Job fear God for nothing?
Satan thinks that if Job has nothing, he will not believe in God. He will not be righteous anymore. He's only righteous because he has all these good things.
Okay. So it goes back to that earlier understanding that it's all conditional. That, if you will, what is at stake here is an understanding of really what is faith all about. And is faith simply a notion of, we'll put it in a contemporary term, cost-benefit analysis?
I've heard it called a vending machine God.
A vending.
Prayers in that you want, pull the little rewards out.
Okay. And the question here about whether or not faith is conditional that way is an accusation that is addressed not just to Job, but also to God. How could it be that one might think God is in on faith in a very conditional way? Anybody?
Can you buy allegiance?
Can you buy allegiance? I mean, certainly we often think about things like, well, that's right. If I'm faithful to God, if I worship God, if I live a good godly life, then God will give me all the goodies. That's okay, right? Cost-benefit analysis. But dare we think that God might also be that way? You know? If you have faith in me, if you believe in me, if you worship me, then I'll give you all the goodies. So is God just as conditional as we are? Think about Exodus. Is that what the covenant is all about?
No.
God taking all those folks to Sinai and saying, okay, here's my 10 words, my 10 commandments, and a few others added on. And, of course, things like, if you have no other gods before me, then what? Blessings are yours. The land is yours. Deliverance is yours. And if you go after other gods, what happens? Boom, the hammer. Right? Exile, punishment. Other nations and tribes around you rise up and punish you. So you see, this God, this covenant stuff that we think, oh, gracious, merciful, compassionate, delivering, nah, it's a deal.
But you also can see throughout the Old Testament a continuing process of forgiveness. The Israelites mess up, they're punished, then they come back and rebuild. Then they mess up again, but you always have the forgiveness coming back. That's something I hadn't seen really in the Old Testament until recently.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look for it, it's there.
But is that even conditional? Right. If you repent, then God will forgive. Or not. Because you see, again, and we'll talk about this a little later in the week, Job doesn't, at least as Job is introduced to us, and that remains through the whole, right? Does Job need forgiveness? No. He's upright, blameless, fears God, turns away from evil. Right? They want to, the narrative wants to paint the picture, if you will. This person has never done anything wrong. This person, Job, has always remained faithful to God, and yet all these sufferings can't happen to him. So, what's going on there? Again, if our condition, on our conditional ways, we could say, well, yeah, of course, you screw up, you get punished. But now you didn't screw up, and it seems like you're getting punished. So what's going on? Please.
In a certain sense, what troubles me isn't that this makes God's faith in Job resemble our faith in God, but that in a certain sense, the relationship doesn't seem quite reciprocal in that way. In the fourth chapter of Luke, in Jesus' first conversation with the devil, you know, the devil's big culminating, you know, temptation, the third, is, well, here, test God. You got all this faith, put God to the test. Throw yourself off the pinnacle. And Jesus knows that, you know, that folks down on earth don't take the devil up on deals like this. I mean, that is, Jesus says, no, you don't put God to the test. Yet that doesn't seem to be one of the rules in God's relationship to us in terms of God's faith in human beings. But it is God's prerogative to put human beings to the test. Isn't that kind of disquieting? Or?
Well,
Well, it's probably more than disquieting. It just doesn't seem fair, does it, right? I mean, so much for a notion of justice. I mean, here I am playing the game properly, obeying all the Holden rules, tearing up my orange rinds into little pieces, and still it'll rain on the day I want to go for a hike. It just doesn't seem fair, right? There is no just God. Yeah, I mean, that's precisely what these first two chapters are supposed to, again, get us to ask that tremendously tough question.
On the other hand, to put in a word here for God.
I'm sorry, God does not speak until chapter 38, but go ahead, foreshadow.
I mean, God could be nervous about Job with Satan raising this doubt in the same way that Job is worried about his kids. That is to say that they might be properly motivated, properly grateful. And so perhaps Job is, as Satan is suggesting, carrying forth simply because he's blessed. What if he's not? I mean, in other words, is Job's piety genuine? The same thing Job's worried about with respect to his kids.
Right. I mean, the question that's here, and I think it's a deeper question that often the context, Job is written at, or again, the story of Job begins to be told at the time when Judah is in exile in Babylon. And, of course, Judah has lost, the people of God have lost, if you will, basically everything. Their temple is destroyed. Their capital is destroyed. Their culture and way of life is destroyed. They're not even in their homeland anymore. They're living in exile. And of course, when these devastations and tragedies happen, a normal question is, why is this happening? Why God? And one of the answers to that is, well, you have been faithless. You have gone after other gods, and therefore God is now punishing you, and as a way of calling you back. But the book of Job wants to provide us with a different way of thinking about that. Because that way of asking and answering the question is, as we've said now a number of times, a very conditional way of asking, right? If we do this, then God does this. Or if God does this, then we do this. And Job is asking, but is that really the nature of faith? Faith in terms of talking about our faithful relationship to God, and indeed also faith in terms of how God faithfully, covenantally relates to us. Could it be that Judah, that Israel, that the people of God have misunderstood the covenant as presented and given by Moses, and as we read about that in Exodus and so on and so forth, that they haven't understood the covenant in terms of this notion of faith? And so in the introduction, and I think what the whole book of Job is going to try to get us to think through and answer is, what is faith? Truly faith. What are the grounds and the conditions for the possibility of faith? And then the next question is, how does faith relate to blessing, and how does faith relate to suffering? That's where it's going to take us. That's when it, and that sense of, what does it mean to live faithfully? One more comment about this first scene in heaven, to bring it back to our earlier comment about a hedge. This is again from verse 9 to verse 10. Verse 9, this is the question that the whole book deals with, right? Does Job fear God for nothing? And then verse 10. Have you not put a fence around him? Or again, literally that would be the word hedge, because often the way back then that you would have a fence is you build a hedge and you have hedgerow, right? So in other words, Satan is saying again to God and God's side of faith, well, you know, God, of course, Job is going to be faithful because you've hedged your bets. Look at the great hedges you've placed around him in terms of wonderful family, wonderful security, blessings, prosperity. Nothing could be better. So you have fenced him off, hedged him off from anything that might challenge his faith. So God, take away the hedges. Take out the fences and let me in, and then let's see what happens. Then let's see what Job's faith is all about. And so now we move to the first scene on earth. What happens when God says, all right, the fences are gone? If someone would read verses 13 through 22, please.
One day, when the sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the elder brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell on them and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of a sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another came and said, the Chaldeans formed three columns, made a raid on the camels and carried them off and killed the servants at the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the desert, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshipped. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord taken away. And the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing.
Boy, this sure adds meaning to a bad hair day, doesn't it? Right? Total devastation of everything he has. And note again, it's fourfold, four, that sign of completeness or wholeness, four that symbolizes the four directions. So he gets it from north, south, east, and west. The whole world, the corners of the earth are all against him. And also note from whence this devastation comes. It comes from others, like the Sabaeans, who wipe him up. But it also comes from heaven. Again, it's not just, if you will, horizontally that all this stuff happens, but vertically. In other words, everything in the cosmos, including God, seems to be against you. And it's such total devastation. Everything is wiped out that in each case there is only one survivor. And of course, you need one. Why? Somebody's got to tell them the bad news. Right. And so it is that total devastation. And then in verse 20, we first see Job's reaction. If you will, verse 20 is Job's nonverbal reaction. And then in verse 21, we hear what Job has to say. But in verse 20, as you look at his reaction, anything there surprise you?
He worshiped.
Yeah. What's going on there? What are those first actions?
The actions of someone devastated and distraught.
And of mourning. and of grief and mourning. Right? That notion, you tear your robe, you shave your head, you fall on the right. You fall on the ground, you're in dust and ashes, to use that poetic metaphor for that. So you think there's that great mourning, and then all of a sudden that last verb just jolts you, and he worshiped. What's that telling us?
Well, I think that almost makes more... I'm having trouble with that, our initial premise, that because everything's going well, he's fine with God. And I think the history of the Jewish people and, I mean, our contemporary affluence is that when we do well, we start to forget God. And when everything's going well, we're likely to start to think that we're doing well. And that it's when we're brought to our knees and that we have nothing else to turn to and we find ourselves inadequate, that then we come again to God. And to me, it's more surprising that Job is so faithful in the beginning, and now it's not a surprise that he, you know, turns to God.
He's doing this in desperation?
No.
If Job were as righteous as God says he is, he should be setting the example that we can all follow. What better example?
Anyone else? How do you understand and interpret or think about what it's telling us that we have, if you will, these four verbs of grief and then, boom, worship?
He is not blaming God.
Not blaming God?
Righteousness and faith are two different things. And Job hasn't got it yet, I don't think, what faith is, but he does know what righteousness is.
Okay, do you want to say a little bit more about that, Paul, in terms of what understanding of righteousness you're working with there, or you think Job is working with?
But doing all the right stuff. And you guys said hedge his bets or cover all his bases, in even anticipating that anyone in his family would do something wrong, that's righteousness. It's performing all the duties. Your word earlier, piety, and kind of a... I have a colleague who calls it pew piety. In the pew, you're pious, but it's a different thing from understanding God's connection to him. That God's connection is faith, and behavior is righteousness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, we saw the same thing with King David when the baby dies. I mean, he's praying to God that he won't die. And so he mourns his death, but then he gets up, cleans up, and worships God. God has answered. God has given him his answer. And he trusts God.
Okay.
And I think Job is doing the same thing. He mourns first because of the losses, but then he still knows that God is sovereign.
Okay.
He needs his renewal.
He needs his renewal.
And through worship, he gets that.
All right. Yes, Dorothy.
But these signify not so much distraction as entering into established rituals. I mean, you tear your robe, you shave your head, then you say, I mean, as we would, if, you know, when suffering a bereavement, there's a ritual, liturgical way to go through it first. And many people manage, my acquaintance manage that, but then these other questions come out afterwards. That makes sense? And he's doing the pious things here.
Right.
The tearing, shaving your head and tearing your robes may not be so much a sign of utter distraction and craziness as what a pious person does.
Right. Yes.
And even these words now have become ritual words for to speak about mourning, and perhaps they even were already for him in some sense.
No, I think you're right about that, Dorothy, in terms of the, I mean, certainly the tearing of the robe and the shaving of the head would be the appropriate and proper ways one would go about mourning.
So he's still being righteous and upright and doing his sacrifices and so on, so we don't know if the full message is through to him yet.
Right.
And that righteousness is, he can't possibly face the fact that he can't explain this. God giveth, God taketh away. Oh, that's what it is. And to face the possibility that this could be not cause and effect, a whole different look at the way the universe works, he doesn't even want to face that. So he falls on his liturgy, his righteousness, his traditions.
Let's look at that.
Can I just put in, I mean, I just to gloss that a little bit differently, I mean, it seems as though there's not only a ritual here, but there's also... in his gloss on the ritual, what he says, a kind of participation in it, as though he understands his own identity by stripping himself further. I mean, God's done most of the damage here, and the Sabaeans and the Chaldeans, stripping away all of these things that are part of his extended identity, and he sort of finishes the job by removing his clothing and shaving his head, and then his gloss is, what I am finally is naked before God. That's the way I came into the world, that's the way I'm going out. I mean, so in other words, he could be simply, before he blesses God, acknowledging how he stands before God and how he stands before God from beginning to end, having completed the job in a way, through that ritual.
Right. Let's take a closer look at now at what Job says in verse 21. That naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. Let's look just at that phrase first. First of all, that sense of naked, and that's what Mark has been talking about. Right? Job is naked, if you will, in naked before God. What has enabled Job to be naked before God?
Losing everything.
Yeah, I mean, that notion of naked, I think the kind of oppositional verb you may want to think of there is what's happened to Job. He's been stripped of everything, right? He's been, at this scene here on earth, he's been stripped naked. He's lost all his clothes. He's lost all his property. He's lost all his relationships in terms of children. He is, if you will now, totally exposed, where? Before God. So I think those are some of the things, and we've talked about that now in terms of that sense of nakedness. Then, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. Now what does the there refer to?
My translation says, and naked I will depart. It doesn't say return.
Naked I'll return to the womb of the earth.
Yeah. That here the womb becomes the tomb, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, in the Hebrew, it's definitely that term there. Is there, right? I mean, because again, it's kind of a poetic passage, and you have to have that parallel in order to understand it. And we have that sense of, you know, womb, tomb, or again, taking us back to Genesis chapter 2, we come from the earth and we go back to the earth. So it's that sense again of how all of life. Or here again, often one of the metaphors for God is that God is a womb, right? God is the womb in which all of our life happens, that protective, nourishing one that includes both life and death. And coming from the womb and returning to the womb gives us an understanding of what?
Completeness.
Completeness, right? That all of life falls under, all of life, including death, falls under this kind of protective understanding of who God is and what God does. Then Job adds to that, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. What does that taking or giving and taking away and blessing God, what does that help us to see? Or how is Job understanding his own situation?
If God gave him everything that he had with his wealth and his family, love his children, and that he had the right to take it away.
God has the right to take it away? Would Job be that bold, or does he just simply say things come, things go, and he's not quite talking about rights or conditions?
Resignation? That's life.
Or is there more faith to that than that? I mean, resignation might be just simply, easy come, easy go, that's life. That may or may not be a statement of faith. Do you think Job is presenting us with a statement of faith here, or just kind of...
Or with God's will.
With God's will.
You know, when you read this, it doesn't say what he said when he worshipped God. However, he could be coming at this from the angle of, look at all of the wonderful years I've been given. Look at the wonderful gift.
It's like he's not boastful that it was him who got all these riches. They were all a gift. So he's just grateful.
He seems to be holding, truly seeing blessings as gift rather than as conditions for being a faithful person, is the way you would look at this.
Well, he wasn't thinking of his riches as his successes. His riches were always... He had these wonderful gifts.
But I mean, it's faithful if he says something even more profound, which is that even the taking away, just as the giving, is part of God's action. Just as whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. Yeah. That's the New Testament way of putting the first thought. And the second thought is basically the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the way of the Lord for giving and taking. Not, well, he's entitled to take it away because he gave it. But, I'm faithful because God is faithful in giving and in taking away, whether we live or whether we die.
Liturgical?
Yeah.
Is it out of a psalm or something that he's saying it?
I think we have taken this saying of Job and at times made it liturgical and maybe even kind of made it a ritual saying. But I think here for Job, the purpose of this is basically saying, I do not understand God's purposes. I don't know if God has the right to give and the right to take it away or whatever. But whatever God does, giving or taking, blessed be God. Right, so I think here Job is saying, as he's now, totally naked and vulnerable before God, I don't understand purposes, I haven't got a clue about rights or reason or anything, but whatever the case, blessed be God. That's how I understand this passage.
Michael, also coupling it with the first thought, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. There is a sense there of a cyclical. Once I return to the womb, there is hope then of being born again, or a new life to come. And also the I think it's a fact that we know that Job is written down from a far more ancient oral tradition from a variety of different cultures around the Judaic people, and who very much had that sense of returning to the mother womb and then life springs anew in some way or another. So that when then God gives and God takes away, that's not the end of the story necessarily. We've already, in that first sentence, we've got the cyclical concept of born, and then I die and return to the womb, and then I'll be born again, perhaps. And then the Lord gives, and then the Lord takes away, and then there's hope that there will be new blessing in the future. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is a concept of the cyclical nature of life in general, that it's not just constant, a linear, just living in blessing all the time. There is a constant cycle of life and death, blessing and sorrow, and it's a cyclical thing instead of our kind of Western concept of this line, yeah. And then it ends.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead, Paul.
I think that's a great explanation. But I also think it puts Job in the same category as all his comforters. It's just one more explanation of something that's unexplainable.
Yeah.
And he's got to cling to some kind of, I don't even know what the word is, but some kind of order, some kind of sense to this. And to admit that it doesn't make sense, I mean, this wind just comes out of nowhere. Well, if it's God's will. And I think he's more in line, at this point in the story, he's like the comforters. He's got a reason, and they're going to come along with other reasons. This is why it happened. You were a bad dude.
Yeah.
And he can't give up that.
Yeah. I think here at this point, and again, that's that sneaky little phrase, well, it's God's will. I think Job here wants to be much more ambiguous and even say, God's will is too much of an explanation at this point. That might be the wrong explanation,
mm-hmm.
Right? I think here as we start out, we don't even know we do in a sense of we have been in on this conversation going up in heaven. But even there, yes, we understand the test, a test of both Job and of God, a test of our understanding of faith. But to say, well, we can explain it all away in terms of God's will, that's not quite what blessed be God would lead us to at this point. So even God's will is still very ambiguous and suspended at this time. Let's go on to, okay.
Well, there's one other thought I was trying to get through, and at this moment I was trying to even figure with what Joy was saying is, I don't know if he's necessarily trying to figure out how he's going to go on. I was feeling like maybe he's thinking he's next. Everything else has been wiped out. He thinks he's shaved, he's naked, he's going back. You know, he's about to die. And maybe he's just looking to figure, all right, if I'm going out, let's just make sure I go out the same way I finished living my life. You know, let's just stay the course. Has he actually been trying to figure out how to make sense of all this so that he can figure out how to continue?
I think the text purposefully wants to be ambiguous here to have us think through what could be all the possibilities and ways in which we could respond to a situation like what would be faithful response. Right now, that's an open question, right? Tough question. So you can't ask me to come up with the answer, right? Remember, those are ground rules. Let's go to the second scene. We have all of 2 minutes, and so we'll do this. Second scene is up in heaven, and here again, just to point out some things, it's once again, God and Satan are there, very much like the first scene up in heaven. God says, have you been doing your job? Satan says, why, sure, you betcha. And again, God says, have you considered my servant Job? He's blameless, upright, fears God, turns away from evil. The key sentence there in verse 4, again from New Revised Standard, he still persists in his integrity. And then note this, although you incited me against him to destroy him for no reason. Right? Again, you thought, oh, I thought it was Satan who did this, and all of a sudden it's... And the other thing we'll see here in this scene is that it is very ambiguous that in terms of who is the agent of all of this, Satan or God? And the answer to that is yes! There you go. There's my one concrete answer of the morning. Who is at fault here, Satan or God? Yes. Very quick. So again, Satan says, well, yeah, but it wasn't a good enough test because you didn't go for him. And so this now is where Job is affected personally in terms of his very body, his very health, his very life. And again, we see the completeness of this in verse 7. He's inflicted with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Right? From top to bottom, affliction has come upon him again. That sense of completeness is there. And again, now the challenge comes, this time in verse 9, from his wife. Do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die. Right? That's the option this time. Note that his wife is there. Let me just add a little trivia question. How come she didn't die?
She's in Job's house, not in the kid's house.
Well, that, but even so, why didn't, as Henny Youngman would say, take my wife, please? why is she still living?
So now there's something else they can inflict it
on. I think, again, the rabbinic understanding, as you read the Midrash and all of that, takes you back to Genesis chapter 2, that when a man and woman marry, they become
one
flesh. So when God says to Satan that first time, don't touch his body, that's you can't touch his wife because she is his flesh. And that also becomes important here because now when his wife says, curse God and die, she is, if you will, is the spokesperson for his flesh.
It's
like the alter ego. It's again Job's own body saying to him, Job, enough is enough. Curse God and be done with it. Get it over with. And of course, Job does not do that. He makes his response there again. Shall we receive the good at the hand of God and not receive the bad? Very much like what was said the first time, some different nuances there that we don't have the time to go into now. But think about that, and think about, this is kind of your take-home exam, is do you think Job's response in verses, in verse 10 of chapter 2 is the same response as Job gave in verse 21 and 22 of chapter 1. Are they the same or are they different? That can be your take-home question. Tomorrow, we'll look at Job chapters 23 and 24. Again, a contrast to what's happening in Job's life and understanding of God and the understanding of God that we have in Exodus chapter 3. And so I've entitled that one Exodus Schmexodus. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.